have acquired swingman Rodney Carney, center Calvin Booth, a protected first-round draft pick, and cash from the Philadelphia 76ers in exchange for a conditional second-round pick. The Timberwolves used a $2.8 million trade exemption gained from a deal last December with Miami to make the finances match up. Today is the first day teams are allowed to sign free agents. The Sixers have called a news conference for later today, at which time they're expected to announce that they've inked veteran power forward Elton Brand. The Chicago Bulls scored their first summer league win yesterday, an 89-84 victory over the Indiana Pacers. Top NBA draft pick Derrick Rose finished with 9 points and 6 rebounds. The Bulls are taking on the Orlando Magic today. The Chicago White Sox hope pitcher Javier Vasquez can lead them to a 7th straight win over the Kansas City Royals when the teams continue a 3-game set in Kansas City. Cardinals pitcher Mike Mulder is slated to make his first start in almost 10 months tonight when the Cards face Philadelphia in the middle game of their series at Citizens Bank Park in Philadelphia. And the Chicago Cubs will be going for a 3rd straight win when they continue their 3-game home series against Cincinnati tonight. Mark Cavendish of Britain won a sprint to take the longest stage of the Tour de France today, while Stefan Schumacher of Germany retained the overall lead. Cavendish beat Oscar Ferreira of Spain and veteran sprinter Eric Zabel of Germany in the 144-mile-long run over flat ground. That's a look at sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, Mahomet, Tuscola, and Danville, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
A Securities and Exchange Commission investigation has found what it calls serious shortcomings in the credit rating industry. Credit rating agencies rank investments like corporate bonds so that banks and other investors can decide how risky they are. And now they are under scrutiny in the mortgage crisis. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
The SEC didn't have regulatory authority over the rating agencies until last year, and this is the first time the agency has reviewed the performance of the nation's largest credit rating firms, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. With the recent turmoil in the subprime mortgage industry, the SEC was especially interested in how the credit rating agencies had evaluated those mortgage-backed securities and other bundled investments. Lori Richards, head of the SEC's Compliance Examination Program, says the rating agencies were overwhelmed.
These were very new securities products. They were very, very complicated. And the ratings agencies were asked to rate them a whole new world here, a whole new securities product. They were asked to rate them and rate them very quickly.
But there were other problems, too. The SEC says the firms deviated from procedures. Sometimes they cut corners. Significant aspects of the rating process were not always disclosed or documented. Another problem, although the SEC didn't find any specific conflicts of interest, the agency says much more needs to be done to ensure the ratings are free of bias, especially since the rating agencies are paid by the very people they are doing the ratings for. In recent weeks, the SEC has proposed a series of new rules to tighten procedures and policies used by credit rating firms. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
It's the 100th anniversary of Henry Ford's Model T. There have been many car models since the Model T, and you can learn as much from the advertisements that sold affordable cars like the Model T as from the cars themselves. NPR's Jessica Smith takes a look at how car companies have promoted low-cost vehicles.
Henry Ford knew he could build the best car in the world, but if nobody knew about it, he wouldn't sell many vehicles. The corporate historian at Ford Motors, Bob Krepke, says that's why Ford and his advisors sought out advertising experts.
And they hired a gentleman that had been with the Barnum & Bailey Circus, and he was a real expert, naturally, on drawing crowds and gimmicks and that. And he advised how we could stage stunts, cars going up huge staircases, and getting the press there to cover these kind of novel events.
Radio promotion would come later, but in the early days, Ford relied on posters and a blitz of them to sell what he called his universal car. The message on the posters was straightforward. Remember, Ford's audience was people who were still moving around by horse and buggy.
They'd say, here's the new model, show up Let a dealer take you on a test drive. You too can drive a car.
But by the 1920s, Ford had sold so many cars, he faced a saturated market. Everyone who could afford a car had one. Randall Rothenberg has written a book about auto marketing, and he says at that point, the mantle for auto marketing genius passed from Ford to General Motors under the leadership of Alfred P. Sloan. He developed the idea of selling cars based on status.
On the notion, as Sloan put it, a car for every person purpose, they focused General Motors on annual model changes, on planned obsolescence, on the notion of getting people to step up to better and better cars.
Car ads from then on were about bigger, better, status, and style. Cars were sold as part of the American suburban dream. But plenty of people still needed a cheap way to get around. Car makers had to figure out how to sell to these people without using the word cheap.
Remember running boards? Those were the days when a car was a car. Simple, so there was less to go wrong.
In 1959, strange commercials for a funny-looking German car hit the airwaves.
They just don't make them like they used to. Except the Volkswagen.
Rothenberg says the idea of a Volkswagen, or literally people's car, came from Hitler. But a group of Jewish-American copywriters at the ad agency Doyle Dane Birnbach helped popularize the Beetle in America.
The genius of Bill Birnbach and the team that was working for him was to recognize that the way to sell cheap, basic automobility was through appeals to status, but not the high social status of wealth, but intellectual status.
Basically, college-educated people who weren't interested in the idea of cars as status symbols. As VW gained market share, another overseas car maker was targeting the U.S. Its first TV ad wasn't as creative as VW's, but it still tried to speak to the average American.
This is fullback Walt Garrison, 6 feet 1, 205 pounds.
Toyota's first ad for the Corolla in 1971 featured the Dallas Cowboys backfield.
Even though it's a low-priced economy car, it's still big enough to put a backfield in motion.
Steve Miller is a reporter with Brandweek, an advertising trade publication.
It was a bit defensive, almost. Having to prove itself against what was sure to be, and what was, of course, criticism from American automakers and true blue American people who had that buy American mentality.
It was extremely smart marketing.
That's longtime ad man Cliff Freeman.
A couple of print ads. This is for the Toyota, I guess, Corolla. What we call standard equipment, some places call about $250. And the line at the bottom is, test price a Toyota, see how much car your money can buy.
The Corolla would become one of the best-selling cars in the U.S., not because of its ads, of course, but on a reputation for reliability. Today, chasing the Japanese in the market for low-priced cars is an up-and-coming Korean car maker.
Introducing Kia. We're obsessed with building a well-made car.
In this ad, a Kia Sephia chases a Honda Civic, and as the Civic enters a posh, gated community, the Kia is stuck outside.
Kia, because it's about time everyone had a well-made car.
It's a blatant appeal to ordinary middle-class Americans. Kia's latest ads are even more blatant.
And it's priced about $6,000 less than a Toyota RAV4 Limited. Or to put it another way, a whole year's worth of groceries less.
Randall Rothenberg says this approach might not work in times of plenty, but in the middle of a gas crisis and with the economy on the edge of recession, it's perfectly okay to market a cheap car as cheap. Jessica Smith, NPR News.
In Minnesota, what is likely to be the most expensive and closely watched U.S. Senate race in the nation has lately been consumed by an old Playboy article, a Capitol Hill crash pad, and whether a one-time professional wrestler will jump into the race. The contest pits Republican incumbent Norm Coleman against former Saturday Night Live funny man Al Franken and possibly former Governor Jesse Ventura. NPR's David Wellna has the story.
Brainerd, Minnesota may be best known as the mythical home of Paul Bunyan and his blue ox Babe. But at the big 4th of July parade in Brainerd last week, the fuss was all about Al Franken, the Democratic-endorsed nominee for the U.S. Senate.
Yee-haw! Yee-haw!
Thank you! Thank you! Hey, happy
Happy Independence Day, son.
Franken's glad handing in Brainerd may have won him at least one backer of his Republican opponent, Senator Norm Coleman. Swing voter Donna Stricker of Pequot Lakes, Minnesota, says Franken made her think twice about who'll get her vote.
He's got an impressive group of people following him today, which kind of makes you start to think maybe, you know, should look at him a little more.
In a state where Barack Obama leads John McCain in the polls by double digits, those same polls have Franken trailing Coleman by up to 10 percentage points. Swing voter Debbie Armstrong of Glenwood, Minnesota, plans to vote for Coleman after what she's heard about Franken.
What I've heard, I don't like. Just a little bit on the radio or on TV.
And what is it that you didn't like that you heard?
I'm not sure. I just know that I had a gut feeling I didn't like him. Don't know why.
It might be the income taxes Franken paid belatedly in 17 states, or the fine he faced for failing to pay workers' comp insurance for several years in New York. More explosive, though, was a piece about virtual sex titled Pornorama that Franken penned for Playboy magazine 8 years ago. In it, he praised the internet as a terrific learning tool that helped his 12-year-old son write a sixth-grade report on bestiality. Back at his campaign headquarters in a St. Paul strip mall, Franken says his 30-year career as a paid wise guy has left his candidacy in what he calls uncharted territory.
This has never really happened before. Someone who's a satirist and a writer who's had a long, you know, and satire uses certain techniques like irony and hyperbole and parody, and those things are very easy to take out of context.
When Franken accepted the Democratic Party's endorsement at its state convention last month, he also made a public act of contrition. He apologized for having made what he called some inappropriate or downright offensive jokes. Franken now says he's ready to move on.
I think more women in Minnesota know about me, the better, you know, this will go away.
But it hasn't for Democrat Gwen Hamilton of Mora, Minnesota. Franken, she says, has not convinced her he's serious.
At first I thought he was fine, but now I've gotten to the point where I've heard so many disrespectful things that he's done and said in his other life that I'm just not in favor of him as yet.
But beyond Franken's past coming back to bite his campaign, Hamlin University elections expert David Schultz says the author of books including Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot has yet to make a convincing case for why he should be Minnesota's next senator.
He hasn't explained, you know, why he's qualified to be U.S. senator and what he hopes to accomplish. And maybe he's talked about that, but that's not coming across.
That's not the case, though, in Norm Coleman's latest TV ad. In it, the Republican incumbent's actress wife, Lori, does the talking in their St. Paul kitchen.
They'll say Norm is a rubber stamp for the president, but he's been ranked as one of the most independent senators. They'll say he's in the pocket of big oil, but he voted to take away their special tax breaks. Actually, there is a special interest that Norm will answer to. Hey, Norm, will you take out the trash?
I got it, honey.
Once the Democratic mayor of St. Paul, who later turned a staunch supporter of President Bush, Coleman is now trying to distance himself from the unpopular president to woo independents and conservative Democrats. Talking in the room next to his St. Paul kitchen, Coleman acknowledges his ads don't mention he's also a Republican.
You don't ignore your party. On the other hand, part of what my whole record of public service has been about bringing people together to get things done, and that's what I sell, and I think that's what folks are looking for in these times.
But Coleman's been forced on the defensive by news reports about him staying in the million-dollar Capitol Hill townhouse of a Republican operative who's done more than $1 million worth of business with him and paying only $600 a month rent for a basement unit, rent he twice failed to pay. Coleman makes no apologies, though, for occupying what he calls a shoebox.
Is there some benefit I got having a room that literally you can only fix the bed on one side? You got to crawl on the bed to kind of change the sheets because it's that small. I don't think that's a benefit that most people would even for a moment be concerned about.
Brian Melendez, who heads Minnesota's Democratic Party, sharply disagrees.
If Norm Coleman is accepting an inappropriate gift from somebody that he's doing business with, it is a violation of Senate ethics and it's something that Minnesotans ought to care very much about.
Many Minnesotans, though, can't get excited about either Coleman or Franken. Republican Jerry Newman of Wyoming, Minnesota, likes the rumblings people in the state have been hearing that former governor and pro wrestler Jesse Ventura is ready to climb into the ring.
This could be a real giant of a race if Jesse gets in there. He's a crazy person that can create a lot of interest.
I think Ventura could well win.
That's University of Minnesota political scientist Lawrence Jacobs. He says polls show Ventura's prospects are better now than when he beat Norm Coleman and a Democrat to win the governorship as an independent a decade ago.
He's coming in with about a quarter of the vote, and he's not even declared his candidacy. That is much better than where he was in 1998, where he started off in single digits and frankly was a joke candidate.
Minnesota Republican Party Chairman Ron Carey agrees things have indeed changed with Ventura, but not for the better.
The Jesse Ventura of 2008 is not the Jesse Ventura of 1998. Minnesotans know Jesse Ventura, and they're still recovering from the hangover of the Ventura administration.
Getting over a hangover? The only hangover they had was the fact that I beat their boy Norm Coleman, and they suffered a four-year hangover from that.
After months of refusing to speak with any news media, Jesse Ventura agreed on Sunday to meet me in a parking lot in suburban St. Paul. He still insists he won't announce whether he's running until next Tuesday, the deadline for filing in Minnesota. But when I tell him his rivals think he's simply trying to promote his latest book, Ventura seems to reveal his true intentions. He angrily says he is running, primarily because of Coleman's votes for an Iraq war, which Ventura vehemently opposes.
That's the reason I run, not to sell books. I run because it angers me.
And here's Ventura again, sounding as if he's already made up his mind.
And all you Minnesotans, take a good hard look at all three of us, and you decide if you were in a dark alley, which one of the three of us would you want with you?
It's a choice Minnesotans could well face come November. David Walnut, NPR News.
Earth and Sky.
Here's a question from a listener about our own Milky Way galaxy.
I know our solar system is placed about two-thirds out from the center of the Milky Way, but where is the Milky Way in the universe?
In this century, astronomers have thoroughly mapped the stars in this part of the Milky Way galaxy. That's how we know our sun's location with respect to the galaxy's center. Likewise, astronomers have plotted the Milky Way's position with respect to the nearest galaxies. But the universe as a whole is a far bigger place than just our local group of galaxies.
Also, the universe is constantly expanding. The galaxies are moving away from each other. So we see the galaxies where they were, not where they are. Trying to determine the Milky Way's location would be like trying to find your way across a terrain where the landmarks aren't really where they appear to be.
So it's difficult, or maybe not even possible, to talk about where the Milky Way is with respect to the rest of the universe. Astronomers generally avoid the problem of describing where the Milky Way is by saying when it is, and when is thought to be 12 to 15 billion years after the Big Bang.